Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me tonight, the storm front to my light drizzle, it's Jamie. Hey, Jamie.
Hi there.
So, we are back once again, I see you again, to discuss the latest episode of The Boys that was released, a few days ago, and it was The Bloody Doors Off. I enjoy the fact that on our previous podcast, I kept referring to, here's a new mystery. What the hell is that supposed to mean? What does she mean by that? And I think in this episode, correct me if I'm wrong, for the most part, if not completely, we got each of those mysteries solved.
That's a crazy concept for us to get a mystery and then have it solved within a 2 or 3 episode arc.
Yeah.
Neat.
Clearly, this is not a Damon Lindelof show. No. I kid, because everybody with the Lindelof love, I get it. It's fine. I love him too, but I don't. And I do, but I don't. All right. So there was some really terrific and probably even thought-provoking stuff to unpack with this one. I mean, I did gauge reactions from a few folks who had seen it. This seemed to be a very popular episode of people I've spoken to who've gotten a chance to watch it. Maybe it's much like the previous one, or maybe even more so to a certain extent. This is one of those episodes that, quote unquote, seems to have it all. Because you get a major thrilling action sequence. You get, we got flashbacks. We got backstories. Backstories of characters we've never met. Characters we've been wondering about from day one. And just so much packed into one episode. So I am very impressed with it. It just feels weird that there's only a few episodes left with what they did in this episode,
Yeah.
I mean, if this was at least a 10 episode season, if not more, then I'd be like, okay, but it seems like we only got a couple episodes to go and you're hitting us with these backstories and major revelations, whatever. I mean, my assumption, and I'm probably going to be wrong, is a lot of things we're watching this season are going to be continued into the next season.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, just the Stormfront stuff alone, and I think we're going to be centering a lot on all things Stormfront in this podcast. The Stormfront stuff has to keep going into season 3. There's no way that all wraps up just in a couple episodes. And if it does, I'm going to be like, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it has to, because it's not only are we learning her origin story, but we're kind of learning everybody's origin story via her story.
Right. It kind of, one thing obviously begat the next, because as we learn from her origin story, then we see the direct connection to Homelander and so on and so forth. This was a pairing that if, one didn't see it coming, you really didn't see it coming, between the two of these guys. That little scene with them catching the robber in the alleyway and where they go with that. it did make me think for a moment. It's like, much like underwear, is there like a flap in those leotards, those tights, for her to actually get to something? How hard is it to get there? She's just going to do the rub-a-dub technique the whole time.
Yeah, it's a little disconcerting. I don't know how she has this planned out, but she's got it figured out somehow.
Right. I also on a once again, as I always do, just for my own personal edification, I was both pleased and annoyed all at the same time, because they were using the song Happy Together in the background of that scene. And as a few folks might know who've read my writings, my very first feature script uses Happy Together quite prominently in a couple key scenes. And I wasn't upset, because at least it wasn't, someone getting their head smashed into, against the wall while, two superheroes were basically prelude to a screwing. But I just remember going, oh, see, I told you Happy Together works perfect for that. My thing is having a guy about to have his head, rubbed against the asphalt in a speeding van or something. Anyway, albino, just staying on the sleazy track with the two of them, There's something she says later to him. I think it's when she's trying to make up with him because he's upset that he didn't know where she was when, I guess it's when she went over to Sage Grove Center or something. And I think she says something along the lines of, "I'll let you surprise me wherever you want."
Yeah.
I know what I thought that meant, but maybe it's just the way my diseased mind works. So I figure, let me ask someone who, I'm not saying you're pure, Jamie, but I'm gonna go
As
on.
driven snow.
Yeah, but I'm just assuming you're maybe slightly less deviant than I would be. What did you think? Do you have any idea what she meant by that? Because I know what I think. And it rhymes with I can't think of where that rhymes with that word.
I'm waiting for the rhyming word. This is my whole day has led to
Because
this.
the word I was going to say is actually pronounced banal, so I can't say banal. You should say, you mean anal?
And now?
Did you mean
Yeah,
anal?
yep. I mean, that seems like a reasonable conclusion based off of their prowess, as it were.
Yes. Okay. And which opens up a whole new kettle of questions, which we will never, I don't even want to ask about these characters. Because obviously as we're watching Homelander throughout these scenes, and they're obviously all connected to her, we're again seeing how he's got his immature side, obviously. Him obsessing about the flowers, I thought was just amazing. Just
I loved it.
and what the thing I loved about it is because he just has it like perfectly placed. It's in his trailer, just centered, and that card, which you couldn't get a more blandly written card. That it reminds me of the kind of thing that I remember many many years ago at my old office. Whenever it was someone's like. Whether it be their happy birthday card or their going away card because they were leaving the company, whatever. There was one woman in the office, and she was like of a reasonably high authority, actually. She was like the assistant director or something like that. She always wrote, "All the best." And it just kind of became a joke between a lot of us because it wouldn't matter what it was. It was, it would be like, yeah, we got a card for someone who we just found out, has got terminal cancer. All the best. So because it was just, basically just a couple meaningless words. I think what he wrote on that, I mean, he didn't write all the best, but it was something like that. It was something that
Well,
had.
it's like watching some like he. It was clear that he didn't get the flowers because he was emotionally driven to do something nice, to do something nice for her. It's like, this is what people do when they court each other. So I'm just following the guideline.
Right. And of course, once again, as we've seen with him time and time again, he starts to flip out because he's believing that somebody is lying to him. We know that's a big bugaboo for him. You can ask Stillwell. By the way, I've resolved that Stillwell is actually the same character for Elizabeth Shue played on in The Karate Kid, and that's why she isn't in Cobra Kai because she actually went and became anyway. So.
Yes, I'm gonna get behind this theory.
Because I just love the idea of those being in the same universe. All right, so yeah, and we can talk about the little bit about her showing up at Sage Grove later because I think that deserves that's part of a different segment because it's not really so much about her as what we're going to talk about now. She finally reveals to prove that she's going to be loyal and truthful to him, she reveals the story behind Stormfront, or at least some of it. Obviously, we still have, there are still some questions, there are still some blanks to be filled in here, but she tells us some stuff which is, if you didn't know it was coming, and the only reason I kind of thought a bit about this is because of what I mentioned on a previous, in an earlier podcast. That I do know that the original Stormfront character, who's some dopey dude, whatever, but one thing about him was he's a Nazi. So it was interesting. It was like, oh, they are going to go there. They are No, they're going right there. They're not even. We're talking about true Nazi.
Right. Yes. For real. Bona fide.
So, you know, again, it's revealed she was born way back in 1919 in Berlin. And we find out about her Nazi past. And, you know, she's got pictures with Goebbels. And apparently Frederick Vaught, I believe we knew that already. Is the concept of Frederick Vaught, they're kind of saying he was almost part of the whole Operation Paperclip kind of thing? Where, you know, much like all the Germans, Nazi scientists ended up, you know, immigrating to places like America to work,
right,
you know, in their space program or the bomb or whatever, those kind of things. So right. Vaught's kind of, the concept of Vaught, not the concept of Vaught, he's not a concept, he's a person, he's part of that. But when she starts going into it and she starts talking about, you know, we are in a war for our culture, you know, the other races are grinding us down. And it's like, oh, geez, yeah, yep, that.
Yeah, there's an agenda, yep.
And one of the things I thought was kind of interesting about what she was saying, and it sparked my brain a little bit, so you'll have to forgive my indulgence for the next minute or two. Specifically when she says the phrase, you know, with an army of supermen and you will be the one that leads us. What made this really, sparked my interest is the fact, you know, okay, she's a genuine, you know, she's a Nazi. She's just, you know, she's not like a Nazi. She's a Nazi. And when she uses a phrase like, you know, a race of supermen, I mean, that's something that's the German, or should I say Nazi, desire to build a race of supermen. That's something that fiction has always been playing with, you know, and of course it does have its roots in reality and history. You know, the idea and terminology that was first coined by Nietzsche, which goes back all the way to the 1880, I think 1883, his book, same thing like the piece of music from 2001, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. That's what focused on the concept of the Superman or the Ubermensch. But he posited it as an ideal that once you try to live up to, you know, go to work towards, and as they were wont to do with most things, the Nazis certainly twisted that concept into one of a master race. You know, the German Superman ideal, Aryan, biologically superior to all other inferior races. Oh, and by the way, in case anyone is wondering, even though Nietzsche died well before the rise of Hitler and Nazism, it was pretty clear Nietzsche was very much against both anti-Semitism and German nationalism. So he
yes. was,
unlike members of his family, he would not have been on board with the Nazis. So just to toss in another observation that, you know, it's Scott, I can't help but make it, but it will help us swing back to the boys, I swear. Everything I just mentioned with the Nazis and the concept of Superman, it's hardly therefore a coincidence that in the late 30s, the Nazis are running rampant across Europe. Millions are fleeing, being killed, or being rounded up, thrown into concentration camps. This is the point in time when the character Superman was created by two Jewish men, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And the interesting thing there is actually 5 years earlier, they had actually initially created a character named Superman, but he was actually a villain.
Hmm.
Taking on the more along the, you know, the almost like the Nazi concept. But they recycled the name to create obviously the most iconic superhero of all time and one who would clearly go on to fight the Nazis in any number of stories throughout the 1940s. So, now we can dovetail back to the actual TV show here and Homelander, because I like that, because Homelander is obviously kind of like the corrupted, immoral stand-in for Superman on this show. You and I had spoken, I guess maybe it was just in the previous podcast, because we were speculating about whether he's even, is Homelander even capable of being racist so much as he is just, he just doesn't care for others, period, because he just thinks of himself as a god, right?
Right.
So the only thing I can surmise, I would say he's a xenophobe, just from the way he's reacted to certain people and the stuff with the terrorists, whatever. And I guess that's kind of a kissing cousin to being a racist.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
So
and a Nazi.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the fact is, as we see, not just from the flowers and destroying his trailer like he's like a tantrum, and any number of his actions throughout this series, he is. He's one of the few people I can actually call callow, because I just love using that word and never get a chance to, and very immature. It's a perfect breeding ground or foundation for, like, hate-fueled beliefs like Nazism.
Oh, absolutely. You know, normally in not soups, you know, we would start with microaggressions and work our way on up to what goes into that soup. He has all of those things, but, you know, also he's got superpowers.
Right. And plus, I think now, finally, can we now point out that his outfit, while maybe some might think it has a Superman-esque feel to it with a little Captain America for him, but I have that flag on the back, it's always felt and looked very German in design.
It's those eagles.
It's those massive eagles on his shoulders, which, let's just say, they never felt like American eagles to me. They always had a very Germanic look to it, let's put it that way.
Yes.
Apologies to any German listeners. I think we might have.
But they're very dominating. And not in a heroistic, you know, symbolism. They're very dominating in a way to suppress anything underneath them.
Right. I mean, it's one of those things. It's almost like I'm probably going to find myself in treacherous waters, because I'm one of those things when you're just spinning out of your head, just coming up with something to say. That's what I do all the time, you know. It's much like when things about the actual Nazi uniforms and yep. military outfits and whatever, which, you know, obviously we all now have the connotation, and at the time, of course, as well, did, you know, with fear and intimidation and hate, whatever. But there's also something very, you know, just on a purely stylistic perspective, there's always been something very streamlined and angular.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, obviously it befits the times, because that's the era of, you know, that's the era of Art Deco and things of that nature. But it's one of those things, like, you know, I mean, it's too bad they're horribly evil, because, you know, it's not a bad design, but now it's horrible.
Everything was very well fitted, and I mean, it's a very intentional military. Mm-hmm. You know, military uniforms historically have always had some purpose to their fitting, right. And this is no different. It's basically it's showing pride of their rank, pride of their body. Those streamlined shapes make them look stronger, more masculine, and more in charge.
Right, absolutely. Can we also, because I mentioned a thing about mysteries in the previous episode, one of the things I was wondering about, I think, let's see if you agree with me on this one. I think, of course you will, of course, you know, pretend I'm Brian, that's all. I think I now realize why she said to Annie that she would be useful. Because talk about a perfect Aryan-looking superior white race example that she can use in the future. Would be
with the history, yeah, with the history that she has, and she could manipulate her mother very easily.
Oh, I'm telling you, if it wasn't for the fact that she wasn't already involved with Homelander herself, I swear I would think she'd be trying to come up with some way to unify those two.
Yes.
And who knows, with this character, she still might end up trying to do something along those lines. I'm not sure how that could possibly work, but that would not be a shocking turn of events, or attempt at least.
Yeah, I could totally see it.
So, yeah, it's a huge revelation, and it's interesting because we're also, obviously, we're learning, and, you know, and whatever level of surprise or shock that we all have when we're watching. But we're also watching Homelander's reaction. Because that's the curious thing, is like, how is he going to react to this? Especially when it becomes more and more clear, when she talks about how he came into being, and, you know, she's actually a part of the stepping stones that led to him. And is it Vogelbaum? Is it the name of the scientist who was his keeper, so to speak, whatever. And I think it's at the end where she just professes this, I don't want to say undying love exactly, but there's a love and a support and an adoration all at once, plus being hit with such a huge revelation that he takes as, oh, someone's finally being honest with me. And maybe even saying more than I had ever thought or bargained for. You know, there's still a lot of stuff she hasn't said. We still don't know. We still don't know what happened with her between, you know, from Liberty to now. So there's still gaps in her story that I'm kind of curious about. But for him, the fact that, you know, you keep wondering, how's he going to react to this? Because he has never, while being somewhat xenophobic, yes, but he's never professed any willingness to be, you know, to go along with a Nazi-like solution. Not again, the way he fantasized about wiping out that crowd at the protest, maybe he would. You know, he might be all about final solutions, quite frankly.
Well, here he has somebody who believes is telling him the truth, which in its way is his strength and his kryptonite.
Yes.
You know, honesty and dishonesty. But he's going to fall for whatever she hands over, as long as he feels that she's giving him something that no one else in the world will, which is honesty. He sits in such a powerful position. Everyone's afraid of him on some level, so people are not honest with him. Nobody's honest with him. His handlers are not honest with him.
Right.
So if he feels that she's being honest with him, she is giving him a gift that no one else can give. She could tell him whatever she wants as long as he believes it. And in the end, it may be the only thing that takes them apart from whatever it is that they're coming together on. If he were to find that she was using him, which I think she is. I truly think that, I think she has a little admiration, but I think her admiration is in potential and not who he is.
Oh yeah. I think she's all about agenda and nothing else.
Right.
Just the fact we know she told him some stuff, but she didn't tell him everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she didn't actually tell him where she was.
Right.
You know, and anything about that, which might be kind of important information. Obviously we're going to touch on her a little bit more when we get into the Sage Grove Center stuff. But before we move on to that, something just occurred to me that was obviously they didn't get into in this episode. And I wonder if they will at all, because it's a question I have. All right. So we now know at least a good portion of her backstory. And, you know, again, long story short, she's a Nazi. Okay, so Edgar, the guy who's in charge of Vought, who's Giancarlo Esposito, not Caucasian.
Right.
There's no way he doesn't know about this. There's no way that character is not aware of these things. I do not believe.
Right.
So are we going with the idea that money trumps everything, and as long as they're, you know, making their stock and making millions upon billions, you know, they can use and utilize her regardless of, you know, what she still represents? Because quite frankly, the company was founded by someone who was part of that, you know, 80 years ago, or did I get the number of years right? Whatever. You know what I mean. I think it was 80 years ago. is the fact that he's already working for, you know, and the head of a company which was founded by essentially, you know, a former Nazi anyway. Is that what makes this all okay as far as someone like Edgar is concerned?
Perhaps. But you could also flip it and speculate that she's actually in charge of him.
Hmm.
You know, or there's an agreement there. You can do X, Y, and Z while I am running the company my way. You have to be the face. You have to handle these things. I don't know what it would be. But it's my thinking that if somebody's been around since 1919, is one of the first soups to ever be created, and was at some point in some sort of position of power, like you said, clearly there's some big chunks of story missing in between then and now. Mm-hmm. It would be safe to assume that the company she helped create, that she would still have some control over some part of it.
That's interesting. I do think they're going to have to explore it more, because also we've also been seeing her in previous episodes. I mean, despite being, you know, being held up as a hero and one of the seven and so on, She keeps making disparaging public statements about the company she's, quote unquote, working for or part of. So I feel that's got to be part of some overall plan. So I'm curious.
Yeah, I definitely think there's some inner drama that involves both of them. I really do feel like, or maybe that she had the company and she lost it, for some, there's a much deeper story involved with the two of them. Maybe not the two of them right next to each other, but in the same circle of the company.
Well, but it also, and then this actually does take us to Sage Grove Center, an unexpected but perfect segue, because we already knew from what Annie had said about the emails and whatever that Edgar is part of the whole Sage Grove Center thing as well. That a lot of those
Right.
communications involved him. So maybe I'm just trying to figure it out. This obviously some sort of a, obviously it's an alliance, duh. But it's almost like who's using who and to what
Yeah.
ends. And again, it goes back to what I said several episodes or several, we haven't done several, a few podcasts ago. I'm still, until it's shown otherwise to me, and it may very well be, after what happened to Stillwell in season one, who knows? I still think there's something or some things that Edgar has that keeps him in a position where he's not, because he never seems to be even remotely worried about, supers like Homelander and so on.
Right.
And it cannot simply be, oh, he's got secrets about them or blackmail material. It's got, I mean, I guess it could be, but it feels like it's something more. And I don't know what it's going to be. I mean, heck, for all we know, just to be crazy, go nuts out there, Edgar could be a soup himself and we don't even know that. We
I've
don't,
wondered that, I've wondered about that myself.
and that might explain why he doesn't even, he doesn't even have a bead of sweat when Homelander might just flip on his heat vision and sizzle him on the spot or
Right,
whatever.
he himself could be a fail-safe key.
I feel that could, and that also what my, that would help me also make his alliance with her and what she stands for be more plausible to me, because he's like, yeah, but I can do this, so I'm not, I have no fear here. I can gather he doesn't give a damn about, people, the America, the human race, blah blah blah. It is the almighty dollar, and it's all about power because they're exerting as much power as possible. I mean, Christ, they're Disney on steroids, quite frankly. Wow, they really are, now that I think about it. It's just interesting because it's not a coincidence that you cast someone like Giancarlo Esposito, and I don't mean because of the color of his skin or anything like that. I mean because if there's one thing he's become known for in recent years, and a lot of that is because of the Gus Fring character, but he's done it in a few other movies and TV shows, he's known for playing an impeccably cool customer.
Yes.
Who, when he does have a moment of rage, it's even more scary because you don't expect it. It's like, oh, geez, whatever.
When even half of his body is blown apart, he can straighten his
Yeah.
tie.
But that's the way he was, as again, obviously, as Gus Fring. That's the way his character played off when we saw him in The Mandalorian. It's the way he's been here. The way he was in, that's another show, which is a piece of crap. I can't remember what it's called right now. Anyway, I'm just, the Stormfront mystery is now making me remember there is a mystery about Edgar too, and I'm really curious about it. Especially because when you had the first season, we don't get the reveal on Edgar until like the last episode, and now it's like he's always in front of the cameras. He's always up and he's always around, which is interesting. So, anywho, so I mentioned obviously the connection to Sage Grove Center, so we should get into that now, I think. Although, before, again, I always do this, because we're talking about Stormfront and Homelander, I gotta say, one of the funniest things regarding their combo was early in the episode. I think they're on some sort of, it's one of those fluff pieces they do on set of a movie like Entertainment Tonight used to do and stuff like that. Maybe it was Entertainment Tonight or Extra, one of those kind of shows where Stormfront and Homelander are sitting there and we see, the gang watching on TV or something, and Butcher and Kimiko, who are although both in, the one thing they have in common is that they're both very intense, even if they don't have much else in common. But I love that they're both watching, and here's where we get our explicit rating on this podcast, where Butcher comes to the realization, it's like, they're fucking. And it's like you realize both he and Kamiko both have that realization at the same time, and it struck me really funny. And just even because we, I don't know how much we'll get the chance to talk about her in this podcast. I'll just so just let me just say it now. Kamiko has a few really surprising and much needed comic moments in this episode, which I really love.
Yes.
It's gone. Those little things and what's happened with her, with her brother, etc., I feel has gone a long way to making her character a lot more fun and likable, as well as sympathetic.
Right.
The moment when she embraces Annie, that got me a little verklempt. I gotta admit,
Yeah,
that was a little verklempt.
she had some really great moments in there where she became much more of an individual person with her own. It's kind of funny because she's sort of like the boys' is Black Noir.
Yes, that's right. I didn't really think of that. That's
She's, they're the counterpart. So, I mean, she has these little moments of comedy, and she has these little moments of heart, whenever, Frenchie would hold her hand, because he could clearly see that she was going through something every time she would see Stormfront. There's just these little bits that are getting us further and further into her psyche, and she doesn't have to say a word to do it. And that's always really fun when they're able to pull something like that off.
Absolutely. When you can pull that off without having to use, words, it's always an impressive thing. And it makes her, and also just reminds us of how much more impressive her performance turns out to be the more you think about it.
Absolutely.
So speaking of Annie, after she shows up, just to do, do like 30 seconds of recapping to get back into where we're gonna go, the gang plus, I guess we'll call her a de-chipped Annie, because we get a chip ripped out of her.
Yeah, that scene was great too. I laughed so hard.
Yeah. Oh, and this is where we this is the start of a continuing thread throughout the episode. Butcher clearly still has major trust issues, with Annie. He thinks of her as chum for the shark-infested waters they're about to go swimming in. She's not exactly thrilled about him either.
Right.
So they make their way to the Sage Grove. Half the team infiltrates. Fortunately, they don't get caught when Stormfront shows up to check on a patient. And that's when you realize she's clearly very involved in what's going on there. And of course, obviously, when we get to the end of the episode, it makes a lot more sense why she would be so hands-on. But at this part in the episode, it's like, huh, that's interesting. She seems to be a lot more involved in this than a non-scientist would be. But you realize that she's got that past with Vought, with the not, and what they were doing, creating the Compound V and superheroes, whatever. So it makes perfect sense she'd be involved in that. And we see that she's talking to that, we didn't know if he was an orderly at the time or a nurse or whatever. And that's when we realize it's actually Lamplighter, the member of the Seven that had retired apparently sometime after killing the woman Mallory's kids. So that I had not read in advance, because I've been trying, I try to avoid things about the boys online, because I would assume a lot of things are taken from the comics. So I feel like it's so easy to get spoiled on something, so I try to avoid it. It's kind of like Game of Thrones. Like, I didn't want to read anything about Game of Thrones because, maybe they're going to say something from the book that'll spoil something for me. So I did not know that Sean Ashmore was playing Lamplighter. And when you realize, as we were just talking before the podcast, that, I had mentioned, I remembered like last week, oh, that's the guy who played Jimmy Olsen on Smallville. The bigger deal to most people is that he played Iceman in several of the X-Men movies. So it's kind of interesting he was again playing a superhero in this universe, only with maybe the opposite type of powers.
Indeed.
So you get the whole thing where she after she leaves, and the horrible thing of him torching that guy, who just wanted to see his family or his sister or something. Had a question. We start off with that one patient who gets out. I think she's referred to as just Cindy. She hasn't. I don't think she's given any sort of code name.
Susie or Cindy or
I think
something.
I think it's Cindy. I'm going to say Cindy because
okay.
That's what I wrote down.
I'm going to call her older, taller, 11.
Okay, well, I'm going to call her Cindy. So, and I had a thought about her because we see one of her abilities is, you know, from afar, you know, she can, you know, she can blow up people's heads real good.
Yes, she can.
Is it possible she was the instrument used earlier this season to kill Rayner?
I would say it's definitely possible.
Because I don't think we've seen another character who has that specific ability to do that.
I wonder how far away she can get and still be able to use it. It could have definitely been her.
Yeah, because I mean, she was definitely doing things from a distance. So I'm inclined to think it was, which also makes the fact that the little tag at the end of the episode that she's the one who got away. Mm-hmm. I feel there's a bigger that makes it a lot more important that's the one who gets away because she's already been used, you know, in this way. So it didn't occur to me until I saw her get away, and I thought, oh, I wonder if. Because maybe there's more of a story where she's concerned in that, and she's connected to that. So I'm very intrigued by that. But what she is able to do, and I guess this is where the title of the episode comes from, she blows the bloody doors off the whole joint. So everybody gets out. You got the guy spitting like alien-like acid, which
oh my god, that was the worst. That's the worst thing to ever get. It's not good.
It's the worst. I mean, I thought the guy who cutting off his limbs was a lame power. No, that's an excellent power. This is a horrible power.
Oh my god, it's just awful. Like I'm looking at this guy, like right from the beginning, sitting on his little cot, like vomiting acid everywhere. I'm like, oh my god, that's like my personal version of hell.
Yeah, it's just
just awful.
I mean, it's basically the guy. I don't know. I didn't check to see what that character's name was. It should have been Acid Reflux, you know.
Oh my, we're gonna go with that.
Because imagine that guy has acid reflux, and basically it's what would happen to him. Kind of similar to what ended up happening to him. And then you get the, then you get the character whose name is Love Sausage.
Oh man, yeah, I just wrote a really big gross. My paper.
All I know is that there's nothing Mother's Milk will ever be able to do or say to ever stop, never not be made fun of for that. It's like, hey, remember that time you were being choked and suffocated by like a 30-foot long penis?
I mean, it was brought up like as a joke against him two times in the next following 5 minutes. He's never getting away from it.
Oh, jeez, how could it?
You can't.
So, I mean, although, like, all the action stuff is really, you know, it's cool as fudge with a CK at the end, about this sequence, really, I really want to take it to the overall episode, the framing device for the episode in some ways, was something that tied to, obviously, to Frenchie and to Lamplighter. It's that flashback story that we get. You know, the one that's, it starts off 8 years ago, then it moves to 5 years ago. And we basically see the backstory of Frenchie, how he became part of, you know, the quote unquote, the boys, the team, when he got recruited by Mallory, because he was apparently a bank robber. Also, apparently someone who was a really big Golden Girls fan.
Right.
And I was going, wait, Frenchie's Betty White? It's like, huh. I would not have guessed that. But I also love when Mallory shows up while he's in custody, and he's already at this point in his, I don't know, criminal career or something. He already has a pattern of coming up with ways to neutralize soups, you know, figuring out their weaknesses, exploiting them, whatever. But eventually this leads to what happened a few years ago where what I didn't know, I don't think any of us knew it until this point, is they originally had something on the Lamplighter character. When he shows up at the typical warehouse, wherever the heck they're holed up at the moment, and just as a comic book geek myself, I'm like, oh Lord, he shows up, he's dressed, he's a cross between the comic book Spectre and Arrow on the CW with a flaming trident. So I would say I don't know, not quite one of the cooler outfits they've come up with, you know, for these characters. Just a little bit too much. In fact, if he just could have been like a guy in a suit with a lighter, that would have been even cooler, but whatever.
Way cooler, but yeah, a little bit too on the nose.
Yes, well, it seems like shows I've been watching lately, they're both proud to be on the nose with things and yet still maybe a bit much. I mean, last night's Fargo, some stuff too much on the nose. Let's name that character Harvard. anyway, but it's Lamplighter, as we know, eventually kills Mallory's kids. But the night that Lamplighter did it, you know, we discover, it's revealed that Frenchie, yeah, he had originally been tailing him, but he got called away because his friend was ODing. And this is what Frenchie has been felt guilty for all these years, because, you know, he left to help a friend who, quite frankly, ended up dying just a few months later from a different OD anyway. And his delinquence of his duties, or however you want, or irresponsibility, which really, I wouldn't really refer to it that way, is what led to the death of her kids. And that's been the weight he's been bearing all this time. But it's a great little moment in the episode when after Lamplighter kind of confesses his conscience to a certain point, and we can talk about how much we believe that or not, when Frenchie reveals his story, and I think his mother's milk is trying to like make him feel better, that he doesn't, that there's no reason for him to feel this, to be guilty. You know, he doesn't, shouldn't be on the hook anymore. And when Frenchie says, "Who says he wants to be taken off the hook?" I thought that was such a great little character line, and it's someone who wants to be feeding off that guilt, regardless of whether it's misplaced. It kind of, and to me, it almost puts him in, he has something in common with Butcher. And maybe that's what kind of unifies those two characters, I think.
Right. Yep, I would have to agree with that.
And the flip of it with Lamplighter, look, and I love that Mother's Milk, again, he's the man. He's on the point that there's, he does it with some well-chosen curse words, there's really no way we should genuinely feel sorry for him. You know, despite his, you know, his unintended torching of Mallory's kids, because he knows he only meant to kill her, and you know, he wasn't there to kill the kids. That was an accident, whatever. He didn't realize until it was too late. I don't know if that really earns him any points, because hey, we just saw you torch a kid who clearly just was a kid who just wanted to see his sister, you know, at Sage Grove. So I was like,
yeah, well, it's like, instead of backing away from what happened and seeking out redemption, he just like doubled down and was like, I'll just keep working with the bad guys.
Yeah. I mean, look,
I'm a bad guy. I guess I'll just go keep doing bad things for other people.
But if I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, and I still haven't made up my mind if I'm going to, one can say or assume that he's in a bad spot. And maybe, you know, it's the powers of Vaught Industries, Edgar, et cetera. And he's pretty much, cause look, he went from being a superhero, one of the seven, which therefore I would take that to mean you're one of the seven biggest celebrities on the planet or something.
Right.
And now you're essentially look like you're just like an orderly in a hospital. I mean, obviously we now discover what the hospital actually is, but still you're kind of the guy just doing menial tasks, you know, with this kind of crappy life, you know, I don't think.
Yeah. He's just doing cleanup jobs.
Yeah. I don't think he's leaving there and going to a mansion at night either.
No.
You know, so I don't think he's living quite. So it's things like that make me kind of shift a little bit over to, okay, he's kind of between a rock and a hard place thing, and this is, and I would buy perhaps he does genuinely feel guilty, bad, horrible, whatever about what happened to those kids. I'll buy that, because that, I mean, it seems like that was the event that eventually led to him leaving the Seven, and he does tell them what they need to know. I mean, he does tell them what Sage Grove Center really is, that they've been giving, that they are test subjects, that they've been giving Compound V to adults. And that's where you find out sometimes they get powers, sometimes they go nuts, sometimes, I don't know, they explode, you know?
Right. And he did tell him that he doesn't have more information than that, because that he is a nobody in this chain.
And he does, and at the end, you know, it's, you know, Mallory, oh, I'm about to sneeze. I'm trying not to sneeze on the podcast. Okay. Wow. Okay. Hopefully that went away. Anyway, at the end, you know, when, you know, first of all, he doesn't tell Stormfront they're there, which he right. easily could have done, and they would have been taken care of, you know, like that. One might question how Stormfront, who has proven herself to be so intuitive and perceptive of everybody around her at all times, doesn't pick up on this. But I think it just she had no reason to think he would be that he would be lying about anything, and she just was like, just clean up this mess. Also treating him like a peon, by the way.
Yep. You know,
certainly not a peer. Certainly not a peer. So he's lost all of that. I mean, he's lower on the food chain than the deep.
You know? Right. Who is heading that way.
Although, come to think of it, the collector should be reaching out to this guy. Anyway, at the end, they bring him, Mallory is gonna kill him, you know, he's got that, I want to be put out of my misery thing. And Frenchie is the one that convinces Mallory not to kill him. So I'm watching that all play out. That's the kind of the resolution of all that. And I was thinking, should I believe him, or do I think he's playing a long con here? And I'm gonna go, even though I try not to think of myself as being the glass half full optimist here, I'm gonna say I believe him, and I'll wait and see if maybe he is playing a long con and I've been tricked. But I'm gonna err on the side of goodness. And say I believe.
There you go. I'm inclined to believe him, because the reality is, we know at some point this story is going to come to a place where the boys again have to take down parts of Vought or individuals in of the Seven or whatever the case may be. But seeing as they're primarily not Supes, they're going to need Supes on their side.
That's true. And again, that would be, even though I only know what I read when I was doing the season one stuff and bits and pieces about the comics. Obviously, one change they've made, you know, the comics, the boys have powers, and they clearly have chosen not to go in that direction for the series. And I think it works to their advantage. So, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, right now they've got Annie and, mm-hmm. And Kimiko. Keep forgetting right. Kimiko is one as well. It just, because we rarely get to see her utilize her powers other than when she was like fighting with Stormfront a few episodes back.
Well, it's like they've kind of become the island for misfit Supes.
Yes, that actually makes perfect sense, quite frankly. So, with all that, we kind of had already touched a little bit on the Annie Butcher stuff. I did enjoy their stuff together.
Yes. And I think it was really, really important as far as not so, I mean, yes, it's important for Annie, but we kind of already know Annie has a moral code, that she is a good person. But I think it was more important for Butcher, because, you know, he sat there and rolled his eyes at her need to keep this stranger safe, and that she was, you know, all these things. And when during the car, and she explains, like, you know, my thought was, you dumbass, you know, why do you have this gun or whatever? Mm. And her reaction to his expression was frustration. You know, don't you dare look at me and approve of that, because this is part of her that she doesn't like. This is part of her that she's always fighting. This is her weakness.
Right.
And he got to see it. She showed him her weakness, her weak spot. But then at the same note, he also saw her look behind when they were driving away and look out at him laying in the road. And so she proved that was her weakness.
Right.
You know, that she is a good person. She really did regret. And in some ways, maybe a little bit, well, we definitely know, has a kinder heart than Butcher does at base level.
I think to put a bow on that little part of it, in a way, they both, for the first time at different junctures, saw the humanity in the other person that they
right.
that they either
yes
had either denied could was genuine, or were never or never really looked for in the first place. So as a result, I think again, it's not saying that these guys are going to be bosom buddies from this point on, but maybe he's not going to keep her trained in his sights and his gun, you know, while they're on a mission, as he did in this episode. I would say that the scene with the guy in the car, and that's the actor, it's Disher from Monk. I was like, oh, look at that. Oh, by the way, also available because he's Canadian, just like Sean. The show must be shot in Canada because all the guest stars are all from Canadian right. actors. You know, now they're named people. It's not, you know, it's not like Legends of Tomorrow where it's just people you've never seen before.
I called him Car Seat Man.
I just again, I was a big Monk fan, so I was like, oh, it's Disher. Oh, look at Disher. I haven't seen Disher in years. And then she's the whole thing with the gun, whatever, and I'm watching it, and I know what she does. She does the little zap, and he falls back, but he hits his head on the asphalt, which basically kills him, whatever, by accident. And I remember thinking, hey, you know what you could do, Annie? You could just step in front of him, because we already know that you can take, like, a round from a giant 50 caliber gun. You can, you know, a handgun should be like nothing to you.
Right. But she admitted herself, his action irritated her, pissed her off. She got irrational.
Right. Exactly. And if there's one thing Butcher knows about, it's getting pissed off and irrational.
Right.
But
and it's so great too, because, you know, we talk about Stormfront and being a racist, and we talk about xenophobia, we talk about this elitist personalities that are coming out of the Seven, and then you have Butcher, who is like completely a soupist. He will not give any of them a chance. So this was is really important for his character to buy into the idea or the reality that these were innocent people for the most part at some point, mm-hmm. That had something put into them to change who they were. And he can relate to that at least on an emotional psyche level.
Right.
You know, he was just a person. You know, he had his little brother. Clearly something happens to his little brother. The anger he already had manifests into something awful. And his whole life changes based off of what the world injected into him.
Right. And it's always an interesting combination with this little group of characters, because he's like the one anti-hero in the bunch.
Yes.
I wouldn't really categorize any of the others that way. You know, even, I mean, Frenchie comes close, but Frenchie has shown from the get-go he's got a heart from the way he reacted and has been treating Kamiko from day one. And maybe, you know, he might even have a savior's complex, which is something, you know, people tend to have in the dating world, certainly, and they can certainly have it on a anti-superhero show as well. What you just said is pretty, it's spot on, and it's not a coincidence that in an episode which explores a little bit, or reveals, I should say, not, I wouldn't say explores, but reveals, you know, a character's true Nazi / you know, as racist as you get past, who's talking and their interactions with, you know, an extremely, at least a thoroughly xenophobic character, and they're the bad guys. And it's also the realization, like, hey, don't forget, one of the guys we're supposed to be rooting for, he's got some issues too, and he's been kind of ignored, whatever, you know, someone like Huey has said, you know, in their defense. I love that Huey is basically the unifying element here. And when they have the moment in the hospital, and they just...
Him and his Axe body spray.
His strawberry shortcake shampoo. And the thing about the Desitin on his ass or whatever.
Yeah.
And they realize he's too good for either of us. But it's not a show I look at as having sweet moments, but that actually was a sweet moment. And maybe it's kind of nice to be able to have moments like that every once in a while, because it's also a show where, you know, the next thing you know, 123 people might be sent to their death, you know,
exactly.
Screaming.
You have to have the the counterpart to that. And it's had a lot of them, like, we're, you know, talking about with Frenchie, you know, holding her hand. There's always these little sparks of true humanity in its better form.
Absolutely. Blow the big echo.
And none of them seem to be, you know, none of them are very, like, slammed into your face. Like, this is an obvious, like, we're telling you to be good people. Because it's filled with bad people. So basically anything that's not the people doing bad things is a good thing.
Yeah, pretty much. Oh, Lordy. Let's see. What else do we have left in this episode? Just a few little odds and ends. Obviously, there was the stuff with, again, the Church of the Collective. I
love that part.
I think this is the first. Is this the first time we've met the character? The character's name is actually Alistair Adana. He's played by the dude who used to be on ER, Goran Bisjinic, or Bisjinic, whatever, however you pronounce his stupid name. I don't think we had seen him before, so I'm gonna say it's the first time. So basically, he's the head of the Scientology like cult here. Okay, you know, I was entertained.
He's got some great Enya dining music.
Enya dining music. I'm entertained by it because I find the idea of spoofing the whole Scientology thing kind of amusing. I'm not saying it's never been done before, but I think, as I said before, I like they're kind of doing, they're touching on things that I hadn't seen touched on before. I love that A-Train says, I saw the documentary.
Right.
Which is, of course, is a documentary about this cult, just like there's been ones about, you know, famous ones about Scientology or whatever. But I did like the bit where the leader basically makes it clear that they seem to know everything about A-Train's issues.
Yes, they've done their research and they can use any of that they need to hold against him. Sneaking suspicion, they will.
Yeah. So I think the more, I mean, if they can play out this Church of the Collective thing to take on a much bigger, more insidious, more powerful potential storyline on the show, I'm all for it. I mean, right now, maybe they're just, it's playing very much in the background, that it may be something that builds up. Again, we only have a couple episodes to go. This might be something that comes to bigger fruition in the following season. Because I would also be disappointed if it just gets quashed in the next couple episodes.
But, well, we're sort of watching a lot of power teams kind of. The story is pushing them all together.
Right. True. And also, speaking of, actually, I weren't, but now I am. I mentioned last week there were like certain little mysteries that were dropped or things that we were wondering about. So, as I was saying, I feel we got resolved as far as, you know, more about the whole Sage Grove thing and at least a good portion of the Stormfront thing and why she said the thing about Annie. And another thing we were wondering about was how Maeve would be able to get help from the deep as far as her dealing with Homelander. And once I realized what it was, I was like, oh, so stupid. Of course. The guy is in charge. He was in, you know, the Lord of the Seven. Well, I don't know if he's the Lord of the Seven Seas on this show. I'm thinking Aquaman right now. But, obviously he would send off his fishy friends to like find, I guess they were initially were looking for the black box, but instead he did find, I guess, an iPhone or something which had the video from what happened on the plane. Bet on me. Should have seen that one coming. However, the Maeve Elena stuff, I don't know. I don't know where they're going to go with this because it seems obvious. It can't go well. I don't know.
There's no way that this ends well for them.
Yeah, but now that Elena has seen this, I mean, it would not shock me if she just finds a way to disappear. Because I think she would want to, regardless of the fact that, you know, Maeve would say you can never get away from him. It's like, would Homelander really even bother? I don't know. It seems like he's got more important things to be dealing with. I would even go as far as she would kill herself, but it's like, why should she kill herself? She hasn't done, you know, whatever. But I'm just, I don't love the storyline because because right now I don't see where it's going to go. That's really going to be that interesting. Although if it's, I know obviously Maeve is trying to do something to build to a confrontation with Homelander. I would be very surprised to see her win that fight.
Right.
You know? Yeah. I could be wrong. You know, it would be cool.
Well, that's because I think the real battle isn't going to be between her and Homelander. I think it's going to be between her and Stormfront.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think she's been around a little bit long. I think Stormfront's been around a little bit longer than her. So.
Mm-hmm.
However, I will give them props for the Brave Maeve Pride Bar.
Oh, my God. I want one. I really do. I'm sure that there's going to be some marketing of them. They're fantastic. They can't not market it on some level.
We'll see. It might be like an exclusive item. I don't know. I don't think we'll see it in stores. It might be
I don't think it's going to be a store item.
It'll be at Comic-Con next year or something like that.
Right, exactly.
And the only other thing I wanted to mention about the entire episode, and then I'm pretty much done with it, unless there's stuff you want to add on it. The other funniest thing I thought in the entire episode was the clip of watching the whitest looking guy in the world singing a rap anthem about A-Train.
Yeah, I can't believe we almost forgot. That was so great.
It was so painful. And then when you see, what's her name? Is it Ashley? You know, I guess she's watching a video version of it later on. And it's like, oh my God, you're so not hip.
Oh, I know. And she's like, this is great. This is great. And he's like, my God.
I think she says it's lit.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, you. I don't think you should be allowed to use that term.
Right.
It doesn't sound right.
We are revoking that. You don't get to say that.
You are too white.
Anyway. Yeah, that was really funny.
So that
was just so awful. I'm just sorry. It's going through my head again.
it was
cringy.
Gorgeous in its cringeworthiness. Yes, it was amazing. So, yeah, that's pretty much the episode. And like I said, it was a pretty damn good one with all the things that you couldn't ask for much more in an episode. You got some real for the people who are just like, oh, I want superheroes. I want sea fighting. You got lots of that with the special effects galore to go with that. You got some great character development, character backstories, and you certainly got some major plot progression and where the show is going to go. And like I said, the only disconcerting thing about the whole thing is realizing this is the sixth episode of the season. There's only two more. That. So that seems a little weird to me, but I guess we'll see what they do. We know they're on for a third season, so that's not a problem. Ooh, Soldier Boy, I can hardly wait for that. But, that's going to be interesting. Soldier Boy and Stormfront. Ooh. Because he's like the Captain America-like character.
Right. Yep.
Oh, that's going to be very interesting. One more reason for we want 2021 to get here already. Anyway, other than the fact, of course, they had to end the episode with thank you for being a friend.
Of course they did.
Of course.
It was the most logical choice.
Yeah. And by the way, producers, you've got two episodes left to use the song Stormfront. I got an eye on you. I'm watching. I was listening to
it. I'm calling it for the season finale.
Better use a damn song. I mean, it's not even that great a song, but I want it to be used.
It really just seems like it should. It seems like such a missed opportunity if it's not. So I'm going to say it's going to happen on the season finale.
I mean, even if you didn't have the Jack factor that he's repeatedly talked about and played Billy Joel on the show, it would still be like, dude, the song's called Stormfront. The character Stormfront. How are you not doing this? But the Billy Joel connection they already have on the show, you got to do it.
Yep. Oh, only makes sense.
Oh, and I just thought of can I call you Stormfront again next week? Because I just thought of another introduction for next week. Anyway, anything else about the episode before I wrap it up?
No, except for a strong word of advice, and that's to steer clear of the halibut because they're a rowdy bunch.
Those halibut, they like a hell of a bit of trouble. Anyway, all right. If you enjoyed this podcast, guess what? You'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page and talk about shows like The Boys and Fargo and pretty much anything else TV related, and maybe even movie related too, or maybe whatever else related. I don't care. I'll delete it if I don't like it. I kid. I won't. No, yes, I will. You can also find us on the Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe to our our feed there, as well as rate and review us. You can track down our entire archive of podcasts if you go to stvdpodcast.podbean.com. You'll find all 270, this is number two, 272 of our podcasts will be there. And as I now keep saying for no reason whatsoever, a few of them might say that they're forbidden, but I think if you try the link a couple more times, suddenly it works. I don't know what's going on. Who knows? I think it's the man trying to keep us down. And finally, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. So, that brings this one to a conclusion. Be with us next week, where, as I said in last night, you know, Sunday nights I recorded Brian, minimum, because that you never know when one or two other people might show up, but you know, part of me kind of hopes no one else shows up because I want to keep those things tight. Anyway.
Clean and tidy.
Well, knowing now that Fargo is going to be on Sunday nights 10 to 11, so which means there's no way to avoid recording, you know, any earlier than, say, like 11:15, 11:30. So it's a Yikes. Late night already. So having like a certain third person in who might just start going off on tangents or dozing during the podcast, whatever, next thing you know, it's 3 in the morning. Anyway, I kid that would never happen. Yeah, so again, Brian and I will be doing Fargo next Sunday. Jamie, you and I will be doing The Boys next month. That sounded wrong. We're doing The Boys podcast.
I almost, that's what she said in it.
It's funny how I do that all the time for years around here, but with certain groups of people I don't because they've kind of used and abused it too much. The Boys. And as I mentioned in the previous podcast, late October, I'll be kicking off, or we will be kicking off, because you know it'll be a different co-host for different episodes. The greatest TV drama episodes of all time countdown, which will begin, I think, in late October, tentatively slated for October 23rd. I'm stymied because I realize there's something that I'm leaving out, and I haven't decided if I'm gonna. You know what? No, it's already set. I can't just put it in. I can't do it. Can't do it. Gotta stick with the plan.
Fate has sealed that envelope, buddy.
God damn it. So I can say what I left out. So sure, I realized, no, because the 20 shows are set. The episodes themselves are not set, and thus the order is not set. Some, but the 20 shows are definitely set. I realized there was something that probably should have made it and didn't. But I'm not going to change it now because I was in a Zoom call the other night with one of our and talking with one of our listeners, David Gott, and we were talking about Daredevil. No, I don't mean a Daredevil episode. Trust me. But we were talking briefly talking about Vincent D'Onofrio, and I went off on a tangent. It's like how much I actually have always liked D'Onofrio from Full Metal Jacket, blah blah blah. And I said, and he's also in, you know, an absolutely spellbinding episode of Homicide, which they even did a Channel 13 even did a little documentary thing on it on the American Experience or something, where a guy gets caught between the train and a platform, and the whole episode is him talking to Andre Brower's character because they realize once the train moves, what's holding the guy together will no longer be. So the guy is going, there's no way around it. The guy is going to die. It's an amazing hour of television, but I realize it's not in my top 20 thing. So basically I just talked about it just now. And when we do the first one, I'll just tell everybody, hey, it would have been number 21.
So that's a fantastic honorable mention.
Yeah. And by the way, unlike most lists I do, that is the only, I am going to pledge as the only honorable mention, whatever that didn't make the list thing that I will mention on the podcast. Because I don't want to dilute the list by saying, well, this is why there's no episode of blah, blah, blah. You know, no, because people who write those articles or do those columns, they don't have to do that either. So neither do I.
There you go.
Yeah. Take that. Sorry,
Dad. Taking that.
Sorry, Dad. No Deep Space Nine for you. Anyway. If I can't put in Babylon 5, then you don't get Deep Space Nine. Anyway.
It's what happens when you start mixing space and numbers.
Exactly. So with that, JB, once again, thank you so much for joining me for the latest Boys podcast. You had a breath of sunshine. Breath of sunshine. The fuck am I talking about?
I don't know, but I'll go with it.
There you go.
It works for me. I think it's a compliment. I'll take it.
Breath of sunshine. You know, Unlike Brian, it's just a breath of whiskey. No, I'm just kidding.
Old man whiskey.
He'll probably actually hear that. Awesome. All right, so I will say goodnight. And this time, I swear, I really will give you the last word. I will not talk after you say something. So
I have nothing to say. You're going to have to deal with it.
Good night, everybody. You're useless, Jimmy. Useless.